I love that in our quotes, Taylor Swift gets the best reaction of all the deep and meaningful quotes we have. Today we're finishing our series that we've been talking about relationships. We've been talking about marriage a little bit and romantic relationships. And today I want to talk about something that maybe we don't talk about quite often enough in church. I think there's a couple of things that when it comes to relationships we don't talk often enough about. One of them, I think, is being single. And there's a whole bunch of us today that come and we're single people, and we often skip by the fact that Paul, one of the early church pioneers who wrote most of our New Testament, when he was talking about marriage and when he was talking about how we live our lives and our relationships, he actually said, you know, for those of you who are single, that's actually better. And the things that you can do when you don't have to be so concerned with your spouse and your kids and all the other sometimes worries of the world that now you're drawn into that you have to do can be incredible. And you could do things for God that a married person can't do because of that relationship. And we often skip over that. And I think there's probably a whole bunch of us here that are single people that sometimes think, oh, it's all about getting married and there's all this pressure and there's, you know, everybody's got to get married and it's got to be the biggest thing, or why am I not married yet? And it might not be that you never get married, but to enjoy this moment in your life and to say, wow, the things that I could do for God, the things that I could experience in my world right now could be incredible. And then Paul says this beautifully romantic thing that if you do get married one day, you can use it in your wedding. He says, but if you do get married, that is not a sin. You go, oh, okay. And what he's saying is, this actually, it's not the decision between one good thing and one bad thing. It's a decision between two good things. That it can be really, really good to be single. It opens you up for all kinds of wonderful things to do in life. It's also really, really good to be married. And of course, he's going to bring us back to the way that we look at our relationships and the attitude that we have and our priorities in life. And that's a bit of what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. But today, I want to talk more about one of the other things that I don't think we deal with all that well in church. We don't always talk about it, is what happens when there's brokenness in our relationships. You know, we often talk about, and I think it's important, we promote good, healthy relationships, but sometimes we talk about all the things you're not supposed to do. Don't date a loser. Don't marry a loser. Don't have an affair. Don't let your marriage fall apart. Don't get divorced. There's all these don't. Don't end up there. Don't get there. Don't do that. And it comes out of this heart for we want to build up good, strong relationships and marriages, and that's really important. But what we also know is that many of us find ourselves exactly in that spot. And all the don't do this and don't do that's all of a sudden aren't that important to us because we say, well, I'm already there. Now what do I do? And not only for those of us who have got to that point where we say, well, my marriage, I wish my marriage wasn't in the spot that it is. I wish we had never let it get to this, but this is where we're at. Or I wish I'd never got divorced. I didn't plan to get divorced, but here I am. Or I wish I never dated that person. I wish I never did those things, but now I have done those things, and now I have some of those scars that I walk around with. It's not only for those of us who have been there or are there, although that's important, we'll talk about that today. There's also many of us who we look around, and we might not be there, but there are people that we love dearly who are there. And sometimes we don't really know how to deal with that. What happens when my parents are breaking up? How do I think about that? Or what if I'm walking with some close friends and their marriage is falling apart or their divorce? How do I approach that? What if it's somebody in my family and I would love to say, don't do that and don't get there and don't end up at that part of your life? But the reality is all of us, whether it's something we've experienced in our own relationships or whether it's something that we have walked with other people through, or we're trying to figure out, how do I walk with somebody through this? How do I interact with them? How do I encourage them in a good, positive way and yet realize that things aren't where we would like them? They're not where they're like, where they would like their relationship to be, or where I wish it would be. And I think it's so important for us to acknowledge and to say out loud that for all of our best intentions, there's times in relationships where there is real brokenness. Well, there are marriages that are just hanging on by a thread, where we find ourselves having dated someone or invested a lot in, and it's fallen apart. Where we have a marriage where it was never what we set out to do, but it fell apart, and we're now separated, we're now divorced, we're in a spot that is difficult and struggling. And I think it's important for us to come together and to talk about what that looks like, and to talk about how do we move forward, how do we start over, how do we keep going when our relationships aren't where we thought they were going to be, when there's brokenness, when there's hurt, when there's pain, when we're at a spot where even morally some of us might have said, I said I was never going to do that. I was never going to do that to my wife. I was never going to do that to my husband. I was never going to divorce. I was never going to have an affair. I was never going to, and yet we find ourselves now in a place where all of those things ahead of time, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, is in our rearview mirror, and we now have to deal with a new reality. So I hope that today you'll walk with us alongside of that, and today I hope it's encouraging and helpful for you if you found yourself in that spot. Or even if it's something that you're trying to figure out, how do I walk with someone in life, or how do I help encourage somebody in life if they're dealing with something in that kind of way? Because I think all of us would say there's somebody in our life, somebody in our family, somebody in our circle of friends, somebody that we were watching them go through difficult things. We don't want that to happen, and we're not always sure about how to deal with that and encourage them and tell them what to do. And I'll tell you this, that a lot of people in Christian circles or church circles, or even if you're kind of on the outside looking in but wish that you could be part of it, some of these issues, relational issues, because they're so important to us and they can be so important and also so hurtful and painful at times, we can feel pushed aside by the church if we've already found ourselves in that place. And that's something we want to make sure doesn't happen here, that everybody's welcome and that we know that all of us on some level are dealing with these same issues. And so we want to be here to help and encourage one another, not to say, hey, there's categories, and if you've already done the things that we've said don't do, then you're put in that category and you're somehow someone, you know, in a different part of who you are, or you're not welcome in this part, or you can't do this, or you can't be part of that. I want to break some of those walls down and say brokenness is something all of us deal with somewhere in our life, somehow in our relationships. Be able to say we don't push people away. We welcome people in and walk together. And we're going to see a story today of how Jesus does that, even in the midst of the fact that we know relationships are messy, and you know this. And not all of our relationship issues or our marriage issues or our dating issues are easy, where you just say, this is what you're supposed to do and not supposed to do. They become complicated. But we want to walk towards that mess so that we can find helpful solutions and a way forward, not to get stuck in our guilt, not to get stuck in condemnation, not to get stuck in saying, regrets of I shouldn't have done that and now I've done it, or they shouldn't have done that to me and now we don't know how to move forward. Instead, we can find together good solutions to walk with one another. So that's what we want to do today. And in your life groups this week, I hope you'll take opportunities to share and be vulnerable and to open up to people as you have some of these conversations. But here's what I want you to understand today, kind of our big principle is this. Jesus didn't come to condemn our mistakes, but to save us from our mistakes. This is so important for us to understand, because we're going to see in a minute that there's this great tension that we have between the moral standard that we have and that we should have and that is put before us, and our reality that sometimes doesn't match up to that. And what Jesus makes abundantly clear, and what made people so upset with him, especially from the religious establishment, was that he didn't come to condemn people. He didn't come to punish and to give people what they deserve for their mistakes. Instead, he came to save us from our mistakes, to show us a way forward, to make up for our mistakes. And that's what we want to learn today. And we want to see that in that Jesus offers us new life. And so today I want to look at a story and talk about three principles that we have for starting over or moving forward, either for us individually or as couples or as friends of people, or family members of people who are maybe struggling with this at this point in their life. So if you have a Bible with me or on your app, your phone, join me in John chapter 8. John chapter 8 starts with a really interesting story, and many of your Bibles, if you're getting there, at the beginning of chapter 8 or the end of chapter 7, it actually says that these verses, the first 11 verses of chapter 8 and even the last verse of chapter 7, are not part of the original manuscripts in the book of John. What that means, just in case you're looking at that and you go, well, what does that mean? Is this part of the Bible or not? If we go back to our oldest manuscripts or copies of the book of John that we have that are hundreds and hundreds of years old, and you look through them, the oldest ones that we find don't have this little section. And so some people say, well, so maybe it wasn't there. And it wasn't there originally, at least. And that's probably true, that when this was first written, this story probably wasn't in it. But what happened was, as tradition unfolded and the Bible was put together, there was so much evidence for this story that it happened and that Jesus did this, and it was part of the historical record of Jesus' life. It came up so many times, and the story was passed on orally, and it was written down. It was in there over and over and over and over, that the church fathers who were putting together the Bible and figuring out how it all works said, this is definitely historically accurate. We have so much evidence that is historically accurate, but we're not sure exactly where it fits in. And in different manuscripts of the Gospels, you see it put in different places, and you say, we know it's part of this. We know it's part of Jesus' life. We're not exactly sure where it fits in. And so it was then inserted here in some other manuscripts, different ways to say, we know this happened. We know this is true. We know this is what Jesus did in this situation, but we're trying to find it. And so along the way through tradition, everybody agreed, yeah, we got to have it put in, but not everybody agrees where it exactly fits in. So it fits in here in John. And that's where we put it. That's where we find it. And we're confident this is part of something that Jesus did and said. An amazing story. So John chapter 8, verse 2, we'll start at. It says, early in the morning, he, Jesus, came to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Something that Jesus would normally do as a rabbi. He would sit down, people would come, and he would teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees, these are religious big deal people who run the religious system. They're the people who study the scriptures and have sort of an authoritative take on it, as they would teach people how to live it out. They brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law of Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. So what do you say?" They said this to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus says, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more." These religious hotshots, here's the situation. They come to test Jesus because Jesus is such a remarkable figure. Jesus, on the one hand, he was Jewish, and for the Jewish people, the law was so, so important. This was, in their minds, it was the law that God had given them, ordaining how they were to live. It was sacred. You couldn't mess with it. On the other hand, Jesus had this following of people who, according to the law, had failed at every turn, who were just, you know, if you were just going by the rules, they always fell short. And so here come these people who are so concerned with the law to test Jesus. "Well, Jesus, you have to hold up the law. Here's a woman who's been caught by an offense that the law says she should be stoned to death. And Jesus, you're not going to go against the law, are you?" And yet they also know, Jesus, all these people who by the law standards fall short are following you, and you love them and you care for them and you're always around them and you show this compassion. But if you follow the law, you're going to have to throw them under the bus. Are you really going to do that? They're trying to get Jesus caught in the middle of his own way of thinking. They're trying to get him caught in inconsistency. Either you're going to have to break the law, in which then you're a heretic and you're in trouble, and we can get you for that. Or you're going to have to abandon these people that you have been fighting for and say, yeah, these people, I mean, she deserves to be stoned. I mean, there's a third law, the Roman law, that he's also going to have to violate, because the Jews, even though their law is we can punish someone who's caught in adultery by stoning them, the Romans would say, no, you can't execute someone, only we can execute someone. And so they're putting Jesus in this place where they think whatever he's going to say is going to contradict something, and we're going to be able to get him somewhere. You also have to understand a little bit about the religious hypocrisy that's going on. And we see it as we read through the story. And Jesus is going to bring it out and make sure that it's obvious. But you see that a woman is caught in adultery. It wasn't said that she was an adulteress. It wasn't, you know, well, there's some evidence. She was caught red-handed. How do you catch someone red-handed in adultery? How do you find yourself as a Pharisee or as a scribe, as a religious hotshot, actually walking in on someone and catching them in adultery? That's how they would have had to do it. I mean, just think of the headspace of these people for a second. We barged in on this woman being caught in adultery. Oh, well, what were you doing there? Did you set this up? You spying? Why would you do that? Oh, and fellas, where's the guy? Because you don't commit adultery by yourself. So why did you bring just this woman? Because she's the most vulnerable? Because the man that she was having adultery with, maybe you put him up to it? I don't know. We don't know. Is this really fair? Have you really come for justice? Have you really come to get what's right? Are you just setting people up and using a vulnerable pawn in order to do it? And so you see that there's this just a messed up way of these religious people looking out for condemnation. Jesus, aren't you going to throw the book at her? What are you going to do? They're trying to test him. They're trying to get him caught. And we see in Jesus' response three principles today that I want to look at for starting over. How do we deal with this situation? Taking what Jesus did as our guide. So here's the first thing. Just as Jesus did, we want to seek reconciliation, not retribution. So here come these scribes, these Pharisees, these Bible wizards, these people who study the law and they've got all their morality figured out. And they say, Jesus, don't we have to stone her? That's what the law says. Don't we have to kill her? The law says this is a punishable offense, an offense punishable by death. We should be stoning her. She should be getting retribution, what she deserves. She did this, therefore we give her that. We are going to punish her, condemn her, stone her. That's what the law says. And instead of doing that, Jesus opens up an entirely new paradigm and actually seeks reconciliation. This is a confusing story. A lot of people have argued a little bit about what Jesus is doing here, because when these people come and they accuse the woman, we see Jesus, it says he knelt down and he started writing with his finger in the sand. And everybody is wondering, well, what did he write? We don't know. It doesn't say. Why is he doing that? We don't know. It doesn't say. And there's a whole bunch of different theories, and I'll tell you the theory that I think it is. There was a tradition that when somebody was caught in some kind of sin, in some kind of bad mistake that they've made, the law says they would come to the temple and they would come seeking forgiveness or punishment, depending on how things went. And the priest that was there would take the accusation and he would bend down, because the accusation had to be written down and the name of the person that was accused had to be written down, but it wasn't to be permanent. And so the priest at the temple would kneel down and he would write in the sand the accusation, what the person is guilty of or thought to be guilty of, and their name. And so this woman comes, and these guys say, what are you going to do to her? And Jesus kneels down, and he writes in the sand, I think like a priest would have written at the temple. Somebody's been accused. But what happens is the woman doesn't get what she deserves by law. Instead, I think he starts writing down other sins that some of those men who are accusing her are guilty of. And when he bends down the second time, I think he starts to write down names next to those sins that those men might be accused of. And it makes sense, because when Jesus turns this around, when they see this, all of a sudden they see what he's writing, and when they hear what he says, it says they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And that's natural, because in that society, the older ones are going to give the cue to the younger ones. They're the more experienced. They're the more wise people. And all of a sudden, I think they start realizing, when they see these sins and they see these names, if she's guilty, and if we're going to live in this cycle of retribution where we just punish and we just give what you deserve, then I'm guilty. And one of the things that happened in Jewish law and in Jewish tradition is that the punisher, the one who would bring punishment, even if it was some of these Old Testament laws that are so foreign to us and harsh to us, stoning, well, you couldn't stone someone. You couldn't punish someone unless you were innocent yourself. Wouldn't make sense. And so Jesus here shows them what the cycle of retribution would look like and flips it on its head and shows them what the cycle of reconciliation looks like. You've come here seeking for this woman to be punished, for the law to be put into action, for her to get what she deserves. And he stoops down and I think he writes in the sand, but look what you would deserve. Is this really the cycle you want to live in? And the one without sin gets to throw the first stone. When he looks around and says, who stuck around? Who stuck around without sin, ready to say, I'm the innocent person. I can punish you because I am not guilty. And we see by the end of the story, he says to the woman, hey, who's still here? Anybody here still to condemn you? No. Why? Because the cycle of retribution means everybody gets what they deserve. If that's what they're going to give to you, that's what they have to be able to accept for them. And all of a sudden, they've all left. The older ones started to realize that it wasn't going to work out and Jesus wasn't going to be stuck. And the younger ones followed him as well. If we want to move forward, we need to understand that as Jesus has come, not to condemn us, but to save us from our mistakes, we need to live in that space. We need to live in that cycle of reconciliation, not retribution. And this goes two ways. One is accepting it for yourself. Some of us have a real hard time with that, especially with mistakes that we've made. I need to be able to accept that Jesus didn't come to condemn me. Jesus didn't come just to punish me and give me what I deserve. Jesus came to save me from the fact that I've done things that should be condemned. But instead, he's given us a completely new paradigm to live in. Now, that kind of radical forgiveness, if we'll take it for ourselves and also give it to other people, you would say, well, that's just going to be abused. Does that really fix a situation? Does it fix a relationship? And some of us have been in relationships where we said, if I just overlook this, if I just said, I'll forgive you, then nothing changes. Does it rebuild the trust? Not necessarily. Does it make the relationship the same as it was before? Not necessarily. Some of you are looking and saying, yeah, but it's too late because I'm divorced and the ink is dry and we've both moved on and there's no way that this is going to be put back together. I know. And that's true. And that happens. And that hurts. But we can still choose to live by retribution or reconciliation. Am I going to continue to punish my ex for the rest of their life? And am I going to try and make sure they get what they deserve over and over and over? Am I going to try and take everything from them? Am I going to try and make this the most bitter divorce possible? Am I going to make sure that they never recover from this? Am I going to always treat them poorly? Even if your relationship's never going to be the same. You can choose reconciliation over retribution. You can choose to live in a space of, I'm not going to give you what you deserve. I'm not going to pick up the stone and throw it at you. Instead, I'll offer you forgiveness. Forgiveness is a me issue. We can all choose to forgive. Reconciliation is a we issue. If you, in your mind, in your heart, you set yourself against people and you say, I can't forgive, I can't deal with that, I'm going to give you what you deserve, you close the door to any reconciliation, to progress being made in that relationship. Even if it's not going to go back to the way it was, you close the door to a more amicable relationship. But when you open yourself up to say, I'm not going to punish you over and over and over. I'm not going to treat you the way that you deserve for the rest of your life. You open up the possibility of reconciliation. And depending on where you're at in your relationship, that could mean a full restoration of your marriage where you're in now. You say, I'm holding on by a string. I'm holding on by a thread, but I'm no longer going to treat my husband or my wife that way. There is power in that because when two people say that, you open up the door to reconciliation. If I'll forgive you and you'll forgive me, there's reconciliation. And there's times where that's one-sided. And you can offer forgiveness. And you may not get it back. And you may not have it accepted. But by being willing to forgive, we at least, at the very least, we can free ourselves from living in the cycle of retribution that traps us. No matter where we're at in the relationship, no matter what it looks like, we trap ourselves in this prison of living lives of retribution. We don't have to. And Jesus, in this story, is trying to teach us there's a completely new paradigm that you can live in if you choose forgiveness, if you choose to seek reconciliation and not retribution. Not just living in this way that says everybody is just going to get what they deserve. And so we need to learn to be givers and receivers of grace. And this is incredible because this isn't fair. Again, it's not what people deserve. And we struggle so much with this, but we have to look to the fact that this is exactly what Jesus has offered each one of us, wherever we're at. John 3:16, one of the most famous verses in the Bible, says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son that whoever believes in him should not perish and have eternal life. A lot of us, you've heard that. That's familiar. But the next verse is so important. It says, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. And if God, his father, did not send Jesus, the son, into this world to condemn the world, what right do we have as his followers to do what he would not do? We'll talk about this in a second, but many of us, because we have a high moral standard, which is important, resort to condemnation. You shouldn't do this. You shouldn't do this. You can't do this. I can't believe you ended up there. You deserve this. Because our morals are so important. And what we fail to see is that Jesus was sent in this world to bring reconciliation, to love the world, not to condemn the world. And there's going to be a time where all things are sorted out and where God brings justice fully. But now is the time, as Jesus has showed us and called us to follow him, where he says, I've come to love the world, not to condemn it. And so why will you condemn the world? Why would you condemn your spouse? Why would you condemn somebody who's caught in a space that you don't think they should have been? It's a mind shift, and it's a big one. It's an important one, to always seek reconciliation, not retribution. But then we might say, well, then does it really matter what we do? Do we just do whatever? Morality doesn't matter. We're just letting people off the hook. And so the second thing that I think Jesus teaches us through this story is that we need to leverage love, not loopholes. Well, is it just a loophole? Do we just say, well, it's no big deal. I mean, Jesus lets her off the hook. It's not that important. Maybe Jesus doesn't care about morality. If we're saved by grace, that means Jesus is forgiving us and giving us grace. Well, then let's just make tons of mistakes, and who really cares? And Jesus is just going to forgive us so we don't have to live a certain way. You need to know forgiveness is not a loophole. Grace is not a loophole. Jesus doesn't give us any loopholes. In fact, if you read what Jesus teaches about law, what Jesus teaches about the rules, he never comes and says, you've heard that there was this law that was hard to follow, but I say, take it easy. Don't really worry. It's not that big a deal. Jesus does the opposite. And you read this through the Sermon on the Mount. He says, you've heard this law. You think it's strict? I'm going to bump it up a notch. There's going to be no loopholes here. Specifically for this woman, you know what Jesus says about adultery? This is what he says. You've heard that it said, you shall not commit adultery. Everybody knows that. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery within his heart. Everybody knows you shouldn't commit adultery. I say adultery starts way before that. The whole intention is you're not supposed to look at women that you're not married to or men that you're not married to with this lust in the heart saying, I want her, I want him, I want that sexual fulfillment. Because that's lust. That's where adultery starts. You think, yeah, don't commit adultery. Great, but let's back up. Let's go to the real intention of why the law is there in the first place. And you know what, when we read this, we all go, whoa, I don't know if I could do that. Jesus cuts out the loophole. Jesus, when he's talking about marriage, he says this. This is from Mark 10. And this is, again, a time where the religious lawmakers were trying to test Jesus. And Jesus says to them, and one of the things they were asking him was about divorce. Well, Jesus, when should you divorce? When is a relationship over? I mean, nobody wants to get divorced. Nobody sets out to get divorced. But Jesus, aren't there times, aren't there loopholes when you should get divorced? And at that time, in Jesus' moment of history, there were two thoughts on the matter. And there were two really big rabbis, and they both had different ways of going about marriage and divorce and how to deal with it. And there was one who said, you know, there's all kinds of things. You're not supposed to get divorced, but, you know, if this happens or if that happens or if this happens, and he had a whole list of stuff, these little loopholes. Yeah, you're not supposed to get divorced, but if she does this, and if he does that, and if she does that, yeah, get rid of her. If she doesn't have dinner on the table, yeah, well, that's cause for divorce. And he was so open with it. And the other side, the rabbi would say, no, you're not supposed to, and he was very strict. You're never supposed to divorce. You're not supposed to do it. There's very few times when that's even acceptable because God doesn't like divorce, and we all know that. But Jesus comes, they say, well, what do you think? And they're trying to get him, what side are you on with this? And he says, and they said, now, Jesus, you know that Moses told us we could get divorced. You just have to produce a certificate. You can read that in the Old Testament. If you're going to divorce your wife, and only men could divorce the wives because it's a very patriarchal society, but if you're going to divorce your wife, at least give her a certificate of divorce. Then maybe she'll have a chance to get married again if she can prove she's not married because she'll be vulnerable. Nobody will take care of her, all that kind of stuff. So, Jesus, well, what do you think about that? And Jesus says to them, because of your hardness of heart, he, Moses, wrote you this command. But then Jesus goes further. He says, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, and now he's quoting all the way back from Genesis before there was even a law. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. In other words, there's some people who are really relaxed about the law. There's some people who look at Moses and say, well, there's times where you should, you know, at least give her a certificate. And he says, that law was put in place, give her the certificate of divorce, because your hearts were hard. But if you really got the intention of what God wanted, you would see that God puts man and woman together, that when they come together in marriage, in oneness, let no one separate that. That's God's intention. He's saying, stop looking at the loopholes and leverage love, not loopholes. Stop looking at how could I get out of this, or what's an excuse to not follow this, or how can I get around the intention of this? And Jesus says, no, look at the intention. The intention is a real, loving, deep relationship where God has put two people together. And what God has put together, let nobody separate. No loopholes. And a lot of times we're looking for loopholes, right? How can I get away with what I want to do without it really being wrong, without really having a guilty conscience? We're looking for an omission or an ambiguity that allows us to go around what the real intention of the rule of the law is. And Jesus is saying, it's not even about the law itself. It's about the intention. So don't try and skirt it. What are some of the loopholes? You know what the classic one is for young adults, for teenagers and young adults? You get into relationships and part of you and your conscience and people tell you that, you're not supposed to enter into certain sexual, physical relationships. And you go, yeah, but what's really sex? How far is too far? That doesn't really count. Well, what we're doing, that's not really sex. And what we do is we're going around the intention. And instead of seeking what's best for the other person and building a relationship on good, strong principles, we're saying, well, but how much could I get away with? Because I really want to do this. In marriage, we do other things. We have lies of omission. I'm not really lying. I'm just not telling my spouse certain things. She hasn't asked. I won't tell her. He hasn't asked. I won't tell her. I'm not really lying. I would never lie. But yes, there are things that I would never, ever say out loud if I didn't have to. It's the loophole. We're looking for what we can get away with. Here's another thing that we do in relationships when they break down, when we're facing conflict in our marriage, or when things aren't going well, or when we've been divorced, and we go, oh, it's not my fault. We do the blame game. It's a loophole. Yeah, I ended up here. Yeah, our marriage is a disaster, but it's not my fault. It's his fault. You know, all the things that he did, all the things that she did. I wouldn't be divorced if he didn't do that and she didn't do that, and we have these loopholes. And listen, sometimes when relationships break down, there's an unevenness in cause. But I don't know if I've ever come across a marriage that was completely one-sided, fell apart for a one-sided way. No loopholes. Yep, part of that was my fault. Yep, there's things I shouldn't have done. Jesus doesn't let us get away with it. And with this woman, he doesn't say, oh, you didn't really commit adultery. Oh, they probably set you up. Oh, you're a victim of your circumstances. Jesus' teaching doesn't allow us to do that. He brings in this tension that I want you to wrestle with today. When he teaches morality, he raises the standard and the bar to a point that is higher than you could ever imagine. To the point where we've already talked about this, where you would say, I can never follow that. Lust in the heart, that's he's considering that adultery? How could I ever be innocent of that for my whole life? He does it with all kinds of different laws. He raises the bar so high to the point where you go, I can't follow that all the time. It's impossible. And then he says to us, and he says to this woman, but I won't condemn you. You go, what? I won't condemn you. I'm not going to give you what you deserve. This is the incredible tension of Jesus. It's not that forgiveness says, oh, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. It's not wrong. It's not that he gives us loopholes and says you can kind of go around things and make it work if you want to. He says, no, I'm going to raise the bar, the standard, to perfection. I want you to love God. I want you to love others with all that you have. And there's no excuses, and there's no going around it, and there's no, well, that's not really wrong. And I want you to set your intention on God's intention. He raises it up there, and then he says, now there's going to be times where you fail. I will not condemn you because I don't live in this realm of retribution, but instead reconciliation, of forgiveness. And I think we have such a hard time struggling with this tension. Because some of us are on the side where we want to say, this is how it's supposed to be. This is what you're supposed to do. You shouldn't have done that. You deserve this. You should be punished. We do it in our marriages. We do it in church. We do it with people that we love that have done things that maybe have hurt us or hurt other people. And we say, you deserve it. You deserve it. You deserve it. And then other of us, we walk to the complete other side and we go, oh, don't worry about it. Not a big deal. No, that's not wrong. We don't want to hold anybody accountable. We don't want to ever say there's right and wrong. We don't ever want to say, no, what you did was a bad thing. We don't want to deal with that. Sometimes in our own lives, we want to have a loophole and go around the side. Jesus says, no, I'm going to point you to love. I want you to leverage love. And love doesn't try and get away with the minimum. Love has a commitment to the maximum. What can I do for you? How can I love you? What's the best thing for you? That's what love says, not just getting away with the minimum. And Jesus doesn't go to one or the other side. He holds both in tension. What should you do? You should be perfect. He actually said that. You should be perfect. That's what he taught. But then he died on the cross because he said, I know you can't be perfect. So I'll forgive you. Not just excuse you saying it wasn't a bad thing or you did okay. You're both. This is what's right. This is what you should shoot for. This should be your standard. I'm not going to give you what you deserve when you fail. And what an incredible tension for us to bring into our marriages, our families, our relationships with people who we know are going to fail, let us down, hurt us. Say, I'm not just going to say, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter. That's not a bad thing. That wasn't bad. No, we know what's right and wrong. We know when the hurt has been committed. But to also be able to say, I want to be willing to forgive you. It's incredible tension. And there's such a vulnerability here that Jesus brings up because one of the things he's putting on display is, I don't want you to just come out and say, oh yeah, I've never done anything wrong. We live by grace when we live by Jesus. We don't just come and say, no, like I'm doing pretty good. No, my marriage has never had problems. No, the divorce wasn't my fault. Not at all. No, we need to be able to come with our brokenness. And this is a vulnerability to say, I had a part in this. I've made mistakes. And that for us, some of us, is so frightening and so scary to be able to go to your husband or wife when you've done something wrong and say, I'm just going to be open with this. To be able to extend forgiveness to somebody who doesn't deserve it. That's the way forgiveness works. You give something that somebody doesn't deserve. But where the vulnerability is given security is in seeing that Jesus doesn't work in the retributive way that is so natural to many of us. Is be vulnerable. It's okay to share your brokenness. It's okay to bring that. It's okay to let God know. He knows anyway where you've made mistakes. Because I have come not to condemn you, but to save you from your mistakes. It's an incredible tension. And so finally, Jesus, we come to the end of this story, and Jesus says, woman, which by the way, sounds a lot less polite in our culture than their culture. This was actually a polite way of addressing it. Where are they? Has no one condemned you? She says, no one, Lord. And he says, neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more. Here's our final point. Grace that Jesus extends is a license to learn, not a license to sin. Jesus doesn't say, okay, it's forgiven. Go do whatever you want. He says, it's forgiven. And implicit here, I think we could say, Jesus would say, and I'll forgive you again if you do it again. And I'll forgive you again if you do it after that. And I'd forgive you over and over and over. It's who I am. It's what I've come to do. But he says, now go sin no more. Use this as a license to learn from your mistakes and to move forward. Not as a license to sin. Not to say, oh, the standard doesn't really matter because Jesus let me off the hook. No, Jesus said there's still a high standard. But this isn't it for you. This isn't over for you. You can start over. You can move forward. You don't have to be defined by your mistakes. Go and sin no more. Go and do something different. And it's amazing because this story that we've read, it starts with religious men ready to stone a sinner, but it finishes with a sinner restored. According to the law, this woman was as good as dead. She should be stoned. According to Jesus, she was ready for a new life. Don't you love that? According to the rules, the law, she was as good as dead. According to Jesus, ready for new life, ready for a new start. We don't know how that story ends for the woman. She drops off the map. We don't hear anything else about her. We don't know what she does after that. But how does your story continue today? What happens for you? Some of us today, we feel like we're in the spot of that woman. maybe it's your relationship, maybe it's your marriage, maybe it's your divorce, maybe it's something completely out of that realm, but you just know there's stuff that you feel condemnation for. You feel like you should be punished. You feel like God shouldn't love you. And today you need to accept that grace to live in that circle of reconciliation with God, not retribution. To say forgiveness is available for me. A new start is available for me. Jesus didn't come to give me what I deserve. Others of us, we need to offer it because there's people around us and we disagree with their lifestyle and they've hurt us and they've caused pain in our lives and we wish it never happened. And maybe it's our own spouse. Maybe it's somebody who's, it's the way that they're treating their spouse and we're struggling with it. And we feel like we got to rock because this is what you deserve. And we need to go back and realize as Jesus wrote in the sand, he was without sin. The one who's completely innocent, you're the one who gets to punish. But that's not any of us. We need to put down our rocks and enter into the cycle, not of retribution, but of reconciliation. And there to find that the story continues, sometimes still really messy, and sometimes unclear, and sometimes we don't know how to live that out, and that tension can be so difficult. But there to find exactly how Jesus treated us when he stepped into this world, into our mess, taught us what the moral standard was, and died for us because he knew we couldn't follow it. That is the grace of God offered to each one of us, wherever we're at in life. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that in Jesus we see how much you've loved us. We see this perfect picture of love triumphing over law. God, we thank you that you tell us what's right and wrong because it's best for us. We thank you that you forgive us instead of giving us what we deserve. God, help us to live and to walk in this life and with one another with integrity, with grace, and with forgiveness. God, for anyone today who is struggling with perhaps a past or present damaged marriage that hurts so much, I pray that today, God, you would wrap your arms around them and that they would know what real, true love looks like. God, for all of us as we struggle with the tension between what's right and wrong and the ways that we've fallen short. Would you help us to move forward always in your love and grace and live there? We're so thankful for it. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.